Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show, the first of 2022. Santa has come and gone, but farmers the length and breadth of the country are still working. Quick shout out to all our listeners and watchers for staying with us right through the COVID pandemic, which very much is still impacting on rural life, almost 2 years since it first appeared. Shout out to our supporters, Grassland Agro and Dairy Master, for helping us to make this show happen. Later in the show, we'll be joined by John O'Loughlin from Grassland Agro to discuss some of the ongoing fertilizer issues. As normal, we'll start with the quick fire questions for Adam, Darren, and Siobhan. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Adam, good few questions here, a good few maybe that built up over the week we were off for Christmas. Question for Adam. Any experience on heat detection systems for suckler herds and reliability of scratch guards, tail paint, vasectomized bulls, etc.? Do you use some of them, Adam? You do?
We do, Jack. We do. AI is growing in the suckler herd. I think for me, look, to keep it simple, it's tail paint and a vasectomized bull. I don't think you can go wrong with those two very simple aspects. That's what we do in Tullamore. And to be honest, we buy in vasectomized bulls in Tullamore early in the spring, and we nearly get back for them, you know, the same price as we pay for them when we're done with them come July time. And really, for an autumn calving herd, they're almost a must inside, because it's very hard to pick up cows, especially on slats. So it's a vasectomized bull and a little bit of tail paint. Keep it simple. I know there are other technologies there, and look, they'll probably become cheaper in the future and they'll become more popular, and they are very popular. But for me, it's keeping it simple with those two things.
Okay, second question from you, Adam. The front page story on cattle being up €150 per head. How much is the factory trade up, and which is best at the moment? Mart or factory for slaughter fit cattle, Angus and Hereford bullocks, maybe 325 kilo dead and under 30 months with the board via bells and whistles. And that's not this week's paper he's talking about, Adam. Is that the Christmas week, is it?
Yeah, so Shane Murphy had a look. I guess we looked at sort of older cattle last week, and we looked at weanland prices this week. We'll come to that in a second. And yeah, I suppose it follows through almost exactly, Jack, in terms of there's a reason why those heavy cattle in March are up in price, and that's the factory trade, and the question is correct. If we look at 2021 versus 2020, on average over the year, beef prices up, I think, 42 cent a kilo, based on 2020 average prices across the 2 years. So if you multiply that out by 350 kilos carcass, you're up at sort of €147. So that's why those heavy cattle are up €150 in the marts. On the second question, as regards the
factory,
at
the moment,
I think. actually the factory at the moment. Marts are a little bit quiet at the moment. Factories are really, really hungry for stock. And I think it's because marts are quiet, factories are hungry for stock. They're ringing a lot of farmers that I have spoke to in the last week looking for cattle. And, you know, those cattle are very, very saleable cattle. You're talking probably 430 maybe of a base for those Angus bullocks, plus 25 to be got for an Angus bonus, plus 20 cent we'll say QA bonus or whatever, or inspect bonus. So you're up at sort of 475 of a top for, like, they're the top of the range cattle at the moment. That's what's been paid for in the market.
Okay, nice one. And the last quick fire for you, Adam. Happy New Year to the lads. Ask Adam. I have suckler bred Charolais cattle that easily make 400 kilo carcass weights, but not until 28 to 30 months old. I'm feeding away this year's two-year-old cattle at the moment, but I'm considering in future leaving them to finish at grass in July. So rather than load the meal into them in November to April indoors on silage, just carry them through the second winter, get them out in March, and maybe come in with meal in late May, June while at grass. Would it be a better option for me? I just find while I get carcass weight, it has cost me a fortune to get there. Long question, Adam, a lot in it, like, and that's as much detail as I have, but yeah. What's your kind of thoughts on that? Like, storing for the second winter is kind of is where he's coming from, isn't it?
And I don't want to complicate that system, Jack, but possibly there's a split in that in terms of some of the heavier cattle that come in. It'd be a sin to maybe store them over the winter and put them back to grass. You know, if you're at a certain weight or you're close to finish, I'd push them on and make sure you have really good quality silage and maybe reduce the concentrates as much as you can. But yeah, for the lighter cattle, it definitely makes sense. And look, at 28, 30 months is still well within the range as to where we want to be. I suppose going forward, we want to reduce the amount of over 31 cattle maybe we have in the system to reduce our carbon footprint and do a lot of work there. But 28 to 30 months is fine. That's what I do. The lighter ones, I put them back out to grass. You're hitting a high price beef price at May, June time. But the heavier ones, I think I'd still go on what I was going at. But just try and get real good quality silage into them.
I just, before I leave you, like, have you any threshold in mind, like, in terms of live weight, we'll say that person can kind of follow? Like, if he says he's getting a 400 kilo car, are you saying anything over 650 you'd feed on or something like that?
Come back a bit, maybe, Jack, in terms of maybe 600. If you were coming into the shed around that 600 mark, I'd push them on, and maybe around the 550, 500 mark, I'd push them back to grass.
Nice one. Darren, quick one for you in terms of, well, it's not very quick, but a sheep welfare scheme, and apologies to Kevin, this probably came in a week ago again. Great show. I follow every week. I have a question for Darren. I started into farming mid-2019, so he's a relatively new entrant, and purchased a lot of lambs to sell on in 2020 and had a small number of ewes. He had 10 ewes at that time. My advisor put me in for the sheep welfare scheme, but I wasn't told I would be tied to this small number of ewes going forward, as I had intended on building my breeding flock, which I have done, and now he's 150 ewes with the rams this year. Is there any chance of the reference year being updated in the new scheme to reflect up-to-date flock numbers at 10 to 12 euros a ewe? I'm losing out on a few pounds, which as a new entrant is needed, and my sheep welfare inspector told me last year I must prove I'm supplementing and scanning all my flock, regardless of how many I'm being paid for. So there's a good bit in that, Darren, but talk to me about his new entrant to sheep and the sheep welfare scheme.
Yeah, look at Jack, he's unfortunate, I suppose, in that he didn't have higher ewe numbers. Now, I suppose there's a couple of aspects of this we can take. He asked about, say, the new reference year. Say, the scheme for year five, which we've just gone through, there was a new reference year for that in, the say, 2017. So at the moment, what the flock numbers are based on is the higher of 2017 or the original reference years to give farmers option. The new scheme, when it's brought in 2023, will likely have a new reference year. What Minister Charlie McConlogue has said is that he will pick the year that gives the most benefit to as many producers as possible. So he said that the reason they went for 2017 was there was a spike in your numbers and it brought the highest payment in. As of what the reference year will be going forward, Jack, I don't know. What I would do, say, Kevin, there is I would be inclined to write, say, a letter in to appeal it to the department, given that it's very easy to see your numbers. State his case, because there has been allowances made in the past for, say, new entrants that haven't been up and running straight away to get, he probably won't get the maximum number, but you'd hope that they might come somewhere in between and maybe put some bit on it, because there is capacity there to do that. So there is. So I would be contacting him to do that. Luckily, if he wants to contact us directly, Jack, he knows our emails are there, and we can get him out the relevant paperwork so we can.
Nice one. Thanks for that, Darren. The second one for you. Can I ask how long should I expect for approval of a TAMS application? I made application to the department before Christmas. Thanks, Thomas.
Yeah, I suppose short answer, Jack, it's running at roughly between 3 and 4 months, say, approval after the tranche closes. It varies slightly between different counties, between the volume of applications in. The last two tranches, we've had full approval of all eligible applications, which has meant that there has been a quicker approval rate. So I'd say he's probably looking, say, 3 to 4 months by the time he's approval in his hand.
Did the tranche finish just before Christmas, Darren? It did.
Exactly.
Right, perfect. Excellent. Thanks, Darren. Back to you in a minute. Siobhan, couple of quick ones for you. I'm considering planting a whitethorn hedge along a long lane into the farm. Siobhan has a few articles completed on this. One, how far back from edge of roadway do I need to keep back from? And two, should I get the digger to scratch the ground first to make it easier to plant, or just go in with my spade and slot them in? So it's timely, Siobhan, hedge planting this time of the year. Talk to me on this query here on the whitethorn.
So hedge planting, Jack, can go on till about Patrick's Day. It's a good time to plant them on farms at the minute. Definitely get the digger. It makes it easier to plant. It makes it a quicker job, and the hedge takes better as well. The width you leave for it depends on your own farm, what machinery is traveling down the roadway, what's the possible machinery that will travel in the future. You're going to plant your two rows foot apart, but the hedge could go to 1.5-2 meters in width. So keep it back far enough, and consider, you know, you might have to have a fence along that roadway while the hedge is growing if there's going to be stock traveling down it. So there's a load of factors, I suppose, and it depends on your own farm.
Yeah. And roots of the whitethorns, do they go down, or do they go across, Siobhan?
No, they won't be too bad on the
They won't roadway. Be too bad in terms yeah, of uprooting the roadway. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Grand. Second question, Siobhan. I'm a dairy farmer in West Cork on hilly land but dry. We usually get out with freshly calved cows in early February. Would Siobhan have any insight into whether it is more nitrogen efficient to spray on nitrogen in early spring or stay with granulated urea for now?
Yeah, look, I mean, the cost of fertilizer, and we're trying to reduce our fertilizer use. I'd be rethinking an early spring application of nitrogen. You know, can you replace that with slurry? And if you are going out with early N, you know, you have to consider soil temperatures at the time. Is there growth? You know, and there will be nitrogen being mineralized. If soils do warm up, there'll be nitrogen mineralized from the ground. So if you can at all, I'd be thinking of trying to leave out that fertilizer in application, or chemical fertilizer in application. On the liquid N, look, some of the advantages of liquid N are really to do with evenness and accuracy of spread. So, you know, you're not going to be applying it into the ditch, so you're avoiding waste there. If you're spreading it with GPS, you know, you're going to avoid overlaps and these kind of things. And there where the main advantages come in, it's still urea, there's still urea in liquid N, so it still needs to be protected. It's still at risk of loss. And I suppose as well, you know, is this farmer, a lot of co-ops, I suppose, are spreading it for the farmers at the minute. So, you know, if this farmer doesn't have a co-op nearby that's able to spread it for them, you know, it takes a lot of storage and everything to spread it. So, like, yeah, I'm not, the main advantage is with the accuracy and stuff.
I was just going to say that, so there's no real inherent efficiency with the liquid N versus the granulated urea. There's no real inherent efficiency.
No, and in a year like this, I think I'd be sticking to what I know as well.
Yeah. Two other quick ones, Siobhan. Is there any new nitrate rules I need to be aware of in 2022? I am in derogation. That's all the detail I have. I don't know what kind of farmer he is or anything like that, or she. Any new nitrate rules I need to be aware of in 2022? I'm in derogation.
That's not too much of a quick one, Jack. There's loads of them. So look, nitrates officially, I think, is to take effect from March, but the the rules come in January 22. So if you're over 170 kgs of N, you have to size sample. There's going to be a 10% reduction in the amount of nitrogen that you're allowed to spread. So, you know, the table that tells us, you know, whether you can spread 250 kgs or whatever. Your slurry must be applied by the 8th of October this year. You can't spread soiled water. I suppose this is going to be at the end of the year. You can't spread soiled water between the, is it the 21st and the 31st of December? And then I suppose of the crude protein as well, if you're over 130 kgs on your stocking rate, you can't have more than 15% between April and September in your crude protein. Your excretion bands, then I suppose things to prepare for, your excretion bands are changing. So they're going down and they're going to be based on a 3-year average.
So your stocking rate is going to be impacted again.
And then like other things to prepare for, like other farmers are going to have to start using less. So from January 2023, if you're above 150 kgs of N, you're going to have to use less. That by 2024, that's people who are on a stocking rate of 130 kgs. And then your soil water storage is going to have to be in place by the 31st of December 2024. So there's loads of things in that nitrates that you're going to have to prepare for as well. You know, you're not going to get a less machine on the 1st of January next year. But yeah, there's plenty of changes. They're all out there in
for a few weeks. Siobhan, is, you know, it's typical farmers. They've waited until now to kind of see when exactly it's, what changes are there. It might be a nice piece, just a kind of a checklist on kind of what has changed now. Here we are in the 1st of January 2022, or it's obviously the 7th of January now. But I mean, like, as you say, not a quick fire, but well done. Last one, Siobhan, has the Department of Ag soil sampling started? I applied but heard nothing so far, ?
Yeah, they have started to soil sample, and I think Darren will have an update on this next week, but they have, and I suppose if you haven't, people have got letters, and even more letters went out before Christmas and they got text messages, so if you haven't got a letter, maybe inquire just to see what the story is, but they have started sampling.
Okay, nice one. Thanks, Siobhan. Back to you in a minute. Adam, did Santa come? He did.
He did. He didn't bring sheep, thanks be to God.
I thought he might have brought a different colour sheep even.
He probably couldn't afford them, Jack. I'd say that was it. Yeah.
Come here, quick one. You need to look at the 21 weaning trade, I suppose. You know, the March trade in terms of what weanings were making. What was kind of the summary piece on that? I see a piece on it in the journal. I didn't get to read it yet.
Yeah, it's some really interesting analysis. Shane Murphy took a look at our MAPID database and look, we've thousands of weanling sales in there from all across the year. And yeah, I suppose Charlie and Limousine, Jack, dominating. I suppose weanling sales, 75% of weanling sales are either Charlie or Limousine side. A little bit surprised Seminole down at 3 or 4%, the Belgian Blue at 2%. I suppose weanling prices up between 50 and 80 euros ahead for 2021. It would have been up a lot more at the beginning of the year. I think maybe early sort of time, September time, those really good quality weanlings coming out would have been up maybe 120, but that has leveled off a little bit. And we've probably seen a little bit at the back end of the year, Jack. I know prices were still up, but the absence of that Turkish market or the absence of any exports at all for weanlings probably maybe impacted a little bit. There was a lot of worry there that they would impact more, but they didn't. And I suppose looking at traditional breeds, Hereford and Angus, I suppose Hereford heifers, the standout performer for 400 to 450 kilo Hereford heifers, up by 35 cent. The general run was sort of 15 cent. I know the average Charlie bull calf in the 300 to 400 kilo bracket was up 15 cent up to 267 a kilo for 2021. But that Hereford heifer up to 196, 35 cent on the
what
year.
What drove that, Adam? Like, what drove those traditional breeds up higher than the averages, you say? Like,
yeah. I'd say maybe a wee bit of those bonuses, Jack. Sort of a lot of people I've been talking over the last month have just sort of starting to say, geez, that 25 cent bonus or a 20 cent bonus or a 15 cent bonus, whatever it is, it can't be ignored. And maybe there's a little bit of creeping in as well as regards finishing earlier. A lot of this chat about, you know, maybe bonuses coming in the future as regards carbon footprint on cattle, and people are switching to that maybe more grass based system. And I'd say that drove the prices of those a little bit over the last 12 months as regards a lot of those sort of bigger factory feeders, maybe in terms of feedlots, have changed those cattle as well. So that's probably helped them as well.
And Adam, the Charolais limousin piece, like the fact that three quarters of the Weanlands that were sold were Charolais and are limousines, is that a surprise? Like, or is that the kind of trend that has been kind of developing over the last like quarter, like 75% is a lot of the stock, you know?
Yeah, I don't think so, Jack. As regards Weanlands, I suppose you don't have a lot of guys in a Weanland system running a traditional breed bull in terms of Aberdeen Angus or Hereford. And in the past, they have been a poor seller as Weanlands. Now, a little bit different maybe this year. But if you're at that Weanland game, it's a continental sire you have to be at, because that's in terms of where the money is and where a lot of the buyers around the ring are looking for. And I suppose Charlie, yeah, topping with six main categories of Weanlands there. You've three bull categories, 200 to 300, 300 to 400, and 400 to 450. Charlie's would have topped three of those, and Belgian Blue topped the other three. Now, Belgian Blue in a lot lower numbers, but Belgian Blue heifers, I think, up at 280 a kilo or something for that average Belgian Blue heifer in the 300 to 400 kilo. Really, really good. And a lot of them may be going for breeding, and a lot of those sort of special ones were a really good trade in 2021.
Yeah, Adam, to stay with the numbers and the money side of things, the beef trade, like, I mean, is there a bit of a New Year's bounce coming, is there?
Yeah, maybe not a bounce, Jack, maybe a bit of a hop, maybe in a low hop at that. But yeah, it's good, it's positive. We're seeing a really good trade for manufacturing beef, I guess. Children back to school, burgers are back on the menu, mince dinners are back on the menu, and that always leaves mince a good trade and manufacturing beef a good trade for January. And that has left cows taking a little bit of a rise. You're talking 5-10 cents there, a lot of cows. Cows are in demand, factories, some factories, you know, looking for cows. And prime beef as well, I guess. Heifers up 5 cents, up to, you get 4.35 now at top of the market for heifers. You get 4.30 for steers at the top of the market. And that's positive. And I think that'll stay positive, Jack, for the next couple of months. We're down about 85,000 head for 2021. We expect that to recover by about 50,000 in 2022. But that recovery won't start until after June this year. So for the first 6 months, I think we'll see numbers tight. And if numbers remain tight, the trade will remain positive.
Adam, a kind of, I suppose, more management and on-farm job. There's lads querying about lice problems in sheds, like, and what can be done at this time. Here we are now in early January. Like, is there you know, something that guys can do now in terms of lice in sheds, we'll say, on cattle at the moment?
Yeah, it's been unseasonably mild, Jack, over Christmas and over the last couple of weeks. It's been unbelievably mild, unnatural almost in sheds. A lot of sweating going on in sheds. And some guys that would have treated for lice maybe at housing are seeing lice problems again in sheds, especially in older sheds where ventilation is poor maybe, and you know the warm air isn't getting out as quick maybe as a new shed. Clipping, I'd say, number one, really good in terms of keeping cattle clean, keeping cattle cool. And if the hair isn't there, lice get it hard to survive on that animal. And there's no other thing then except a second treatment. So a lot of those treatments are only last 6 to 8 weeks. So if you treat it early, you might have to go back in with a second treatment there just to be sure. But just important, again, to adhere to withdrawal dates or whatever. If you go back in with a second date and your cattle is close to killing, you need to be careful there as regards withdrawal dates.
The other nice piece you have, Adam, is you had a look, I suppose, at the blue sky prices that happened for a lot of pedigree cattle, we'll say, over the year in 2021. There was some big money paid for pedigree cattle in 21.
Unbelievable, cattle and sheep. I suppose we start off with the sheep. You know, Richard Thompson and Donegal, an unbelievable year. The Ballantone Suffolk flock, 44,000 for his Suffolk ram went to the Northern Ireland. Texas as well hit 10,000 twice. Cork breeder and Limerick breeder again on 10,000. And the cattle were very similar. You had 13,200 to our own Shane Murphy just before Christmas for his Angus heifer. That was a record broke in terms of Red Angus. You had Charlie's and Elfin just before Christmas as well hit 19,000 for New Gaul. A breeder, imagine a new breeder, one of his first cattle to sell, and he comes out with a bull at 19,000.
That's like a bad dog. Like, if you get a bad dog to win in the first round, like, you're in trouble probably for the rest of your life. Like,
David had a couple of children with him at that sale in Elfin, and I guarantee you, every sale they go out now, they'll expect if he doesn't hit over 10, yeah. but all breeds, I suppose, all breeds. And look at a standout 18,000 for that little limousine heifer in at the Fat Stock Show in Carrick as well. Ah, great to see it, Jack. And I suppose. Yes. The importance of that export trade. A lot of those cattle actually either went north or went across the water to England or Scotland. It just shows you the importance of that export trade.
And Adam, is it a friend said it to me over Christmas, and we were talking actually about that farmer from Laois. I think he's into the Scannon as well, isn't he?
Sean Ramsbottom.
They had that little red limousine commercial heifer. Like, but is it a lot of, I call them non-farmers, you know what I mean, that maybe have a square of ground. They're non-commercial farmers. They're like they're farmers, as you know, but that they're specialising in the pedigree piece. And a kind of a couple of cows and a couple of cattle, and trying to get the real top notch, you know, high price pedigree cattle. Is that real, like, or is it still, you know, is that only pie in the sky? That's
there probably is a bit of that, Jack. That 18,000 heifer actually went to a couple of professional outfits now in Scotland and Northern Ireland that are into that show stock. She'll be flush. She'll produce maybe hundreds of embryos, and she'll make a lot of money for those outfits. But yeah, maybe the 3,000-4,000 for that commercial heifer, that's probably maybe, yeah, no, young fellas or young lassies maybe wanting to get that 5,000 or 10,000 or maybe dreaming a little bit big maybe. But look, it's still very positive to see. And to be honest, it's an avenue for a lot of young people. If you went to Carrick and Shannon, you've seen the amount of young people involved in that whole scene in terms of those high-end good cattle. I think it's a brilliant avenue to get those young people interested in agriculture and interested in cattle and interested in stock. And look, we can't knock it. I think it's really good.
No, it is what it is. Adam, you were to chat with John O'Loughlin from Grattan Agro there earlier. We'll hear it in a few minutes, but what did you get chatted about?
Yeah, we wanted to talk about Munster's performance against Connacht last weekend, but he didn't. Funny enough, he didn't want to.
Go handy. We're going to take that out if it's there. Like, you know,
he talked about referees and weather, typical Munster excuses. But anyway, we had a really good chat, Jack, about, I suppose, gas prices. I'm hearing about gas prices for the last 2 months, and I wanted to understand why is gas prices driving fertilizer price and what's the whole procedure. And he was just talking about the other things as well, logistics about getting fertilizer in, and how gas prices could maybe impact fertilizer going forward, and will it come down? We also talked about slurry. I know up in this end of the country, Jack, we look at slurry as a problem. What will happen now, I guarantee, on the 1st of February, we'll get a couple of dry days. There'll be a panic to get tanks emptied. Contractor will pull into the yard. He'll have one reel of pipe, and that slurry will go on 3 fields around the shed, and he'll be gone again in a couple of hours. We're just talking about, look at changing that round, reducing the application rate, trying to target that slurry on certain fields on the farm that really need it, and utilizing that slurry for maybe some of your silage crop for 2022. So really interesting stuff and really applicable stuff for the next couple of weeks.
Thanks, Adam. Chat to you next week. Darren, I have to start with an apology. I didn't read the feature yet on the sheep shed on the buildings page. But before we come to it, like, I mean, I often feel that, you know, sheep will say in terms of a sheep shed, there's a lot of space tied up in terms of the feed face, we'll say, and a lot of the pens aren't kind of that deep, as in you need a lot of feed face, like, we'll say, for feeding yours, we'll say. Am I right or wrong, or kind of what where's my theory in terms of the feed face being a lot more feed face than actual kind of, I suppose, holding space in the pen, if you know what I mean?
As you look at your Ajax, like, if you look at the standard pen, is probably your 15-9, say, along the front, but a lot of fellas go for 15-foot deep pin behind it. Yeah. And that 15-foot deep pin, yes, you can put in 14, 15 yaws in that, but you're only going to have space for 8, 9, 10, depends on how big your yaws are. So unless you've walked through truss, or you've good knees and want to put in some truss or feeding concentrates in the middle of it, that's where your costs say on a lot of time. Like, and even with, I suppose, look at the best design is a narrow pin, like or else deep.
I saw that photo this week now. Like, I call them narrow pins. I just saw the photo in the journal. Like, I didn't, as I said, I didn't read it yet. But I mean, are they narrow pins? Would you class them as narrow pins? We'll say in that shed in the journal this week.
I suppose they're narrow along the front. In the say he's losing the space of a walk through truss. So you're down. You're losing, say, your 2'6" for that walk-through truss. So you haven't a huge amount of feed space. And I think I've already got a few comments on that, Jack, is this, I often talk about this, every year coming to eat, every year having enough space. And Pat Nuttall actually has acres of space, but he doesn't use it. And what I mean by that is that for forage, for silage. So he has walk-through feeders on both sides of his pins. Them pins are about 20 foot deep. Okay. So he has acres of space for feeding concentrates. His space on the silage front is actually narrower because he has anywhere from 28 to 35 yaws in the pin, depending on the size. Okay. And all he's offering silage on is along the front. Okay. So the first thing you say is that he's underfeeding on silage or that he hasn't enough feed space. Yeah. He'll argue that he's doing this he built the shed 35 years ago. He has never fed along the walk to truss. But he feeds
silage. He's never fed silage along the walkthroughs.
Yes. Yeah. But he feeds silage a number of times a day. So he's feeding about 3 times a day. And he's feeding, say, the reason I suppose he's able to do that is he's feeding with a straw blower. So the shed is 7 spans long, 2 spans wide. He has other sheds where he's using a straw blower for, say, bedding down Angus cattle and that. So right. He's coming along, blows out his silage, walks along. He said once a day as he's walking up along, literally just pushes in a bit of silage, and then if he needs to tip it up during the day, say in the evening before he finishes off, he tips it up. As he comes closer to lambing, his concentrates become a lot more important, and he said they're eating less silage anyway. So for him, it's not a problem. He's top quality silage. It wouldn't be something I'd be recommending fellas to go and do now, is to say, don't be have enough room for silage or for hay or whatever. But for him, it's working. And I think you really need to look at the sort of system, read the article to see what it is. But look, at what I thought is very interesting about that visit, Jack, is I went down, and a lot of visits, look, at whether it be me, Aidan, Adam, whoever goes to look at a new building, it's usually a brand spanking new building. Yeah. The animals have been in, if they've been in it at all, or as they're in it for maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks, and you haven't got to test on what's working, what's not working.
Yeah.
So for here, there was a lot of things at play in this. He built the shed 35 years ago. For the first 10 or 11 years, or actually it could be more, could be 14 years, it was straw bedded.
Right.
Using a lot of straw, big cost in straw, big amount of labour gone in. He came in and he replaced that with slats. So the shed, I suppose, he was able to do it in this. It's on a slope. So what he did at the back was he dug out the tanks. The tanks are about 4 foot deep. But he actually didn't have to worry about putting in a sump for agitation or anything. Because there's a fall from the front of the shed to the back of the shed of about 3 foot, what he has is a ramp at the back, and he comes in every 2 years with his front loader, lifts off the slats, and he cleans it out as if he's clean and done. So it's something that people can look at, I suppose, as the price of straw is increasing. Because like if you look at where most of the sheep are along the Western Seaboard, the straw isn't there. If you look at the straw incorporation measure, I think, Jack, we're looking at, we're definitely not going to ever return to the prices of 8 and 10 euros a bale for straw. I don't think now, unless
I think Siobhan won't let him get there. Like, you know,
I don't think so. I've often argued with Siobhan when she started writing about straw prices this year. Give her some chance, like the rival of the straw price.
There's no love there.
But I suppose, look at when we come back to it, it's something that can be looked at, how to convert the shed. There was, I won't spend too long, but there was a couple other bits I thought was fascinating in the shed. The steel or the sheeting in the roof was every bit as good when you looked up as a new shed was put up. There was no cobwebs, no nothing. I said, had your power hose? He said, no. There's a 1.2 meter opening running the whole way around the shed. And for a lot of farmers, we come in and we think we need vintage sheeting, we need dock boarding. There's that net lawn, or say, do you know that mesh sort of thing?
Yeah.
That's around the sides of the shed. There is a bit of an overhang around it. And he said, look, if the prevailing wind is coming at the wrong direction, there might be a bit of water coming in.
Yeah.
That he has slats, he doesn't really mind. But the oars are winter shorn. He isn't in an area that gets a lot of snow. And he said, there's no real problem. The oars are healthy. They get acclimatized to it.
Yeah.
But it, Ginny, when you walk into that shed, Jack, the ventilation is brilliant. There isn't a sniff of dung of anything. But it shows in regards that it has kept the shed sort of fresh as well. The other couple of bits is this, and I get on to why I originally came down for the visit in a second, but these slats, one of the things with mesh slats is we're often, I suppose, maybe looking at them lasting 10, 12 years. There's a couple of things, I suppose, he puts it down to, is that the minute the oars leave, he's came in, they're washed. And he said that is important. He also has more timbers in the slats in that there's less pressure on the mesh. And he has got a good lifetime out of them. And he reckons we'll probably get another 5 to 8 years, with the exception of maybe replacing an odd small bit.
He's saying that he'd get up to 20 years with the mesh slats there. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, he's already at sort of seven. He replaced them in 2006, so he's already at 15, 16 years. He reckons he's going to get well into 20 years by minding them that way. Now, there is differences in when you walk down, some the same as in every shed, some yours are a bit dirtier. But that he comes in once a month and just washes them down as well.
Okay.
But the fact that he's coming in cleaning them, they're well looked after, I think, is a big one. And the other one, I suppose the original why I went down to visit was he was after putting in new barriers, and the existing barriers, the existing walkthroughs are there for 35 years. Now, I know there'll be a lot of fellas, Jack, come on and they comment, sure, steel isn't being made what it's like. But he looked around and he went for a sort of bespoke barrier in that they're based on the O'Donovan calf, barriers, which are a lot, I suppose, maybe stronger than usual. Now, look at the cost. They're over 560 euros for a barrier. But they are bespoke. They're heavy duty. And the one thing, I suppose, that he wanted was he wanted a barrier where the gate would open from top to bottom in the jaws jumping out or having to hop out over a lot of barriers. There is a gate on them.
Yeah.
And that's adding cost because he's a pillar in the middle. He's also two pillars of both sides. But if they are a fine job, Jack, look at their lifetime job for anyone that wants. There's also, I suppose, maybe a few different bits on adjustable height, that type of thing.
Yeah.
I was talking to O'Donovan's because I said, look, for somewhere in between, for the person who doesn't want to go for Pat's, say, maybe extreme job, or that wants to go for the next grade down, and they're doing a new barrier based on that, say, calf barrier that opens. It can swing at the gate or it can open the full length of the barrier. And they said they're selling actually quite a few of them. So look, it's just something different, Jack. You can see it there.
People
can
read it themselves. And before we leave it, Darren, what triggered me on the kind of feet face piece was that Brian Nicholson writing there in A Farmer Writes, like, and he talks about he's TMR feeding. Like, obviously he's a large sheep farmer there in Kilkenny. Is there a lot of sheep farmers TMRing, like we'll say, like that? Or is that just kind of, you know, is that Brian's system because of his scale, et cetera, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'd say if you were to put a percentage on it, Jack, you'd probably need a 0.000.
Right, you need
coming
the
into
zeros,
it.
Like, yeah.
Yes. In the, but there is some fellas, and it's increasing, and the fellas that are specialised in sheep running big numbers. There's a good few more fellas actually looking at it from, I suppose, the same as from a few different aspects. It's like what Pat said about he would never go back to the straw blower. He doesn't need, I suppose, the diet feed or the TMR side, but he said just for efficiency in feeding. And it's the same way sort of in Brian's, in that he's running upwards of 1,100 euros. And it's a labour efficiency piece, if nothing else. And it's also, I suppose, maybe he can formulate the diet to exactly what they need. But there's a big thing around the labour side of things, more so than saying that yours have to be fed or that there's huge advantages in coming in and feeding the TMR. Yes, there is some, but it's around efficiency.
Yeah, I better get two more quick ones for you, Darren, or Siobhan might walk out. In terms of the Board BIA certification, those audits, they're gone back remote job because of the COVID. I mean, what is there any changes? Like they were remote before, they came back to in person. They're remote. Remote now again. Any changes or kind of what are Board BIA putting in place for that?
Yeah, so look, we're back to remote. Anyone that's in the scheme before now will have done a remote audit, because they've had to with the way certification is run. So they're back to, I suppose, maybe look at taking photos of the documents, taking photos of the facilities, of the animals, of handling units, of the medicine storage, chemical storage, and they're uploading that. Now, Board BIA are hoping that that's only going to last for about a month, 6 weeks. They really want to get back to the on-farm element as well, because look at, I suppose, to strengthen up the scheme, they can't go for too many years with remote audits. And in the future, they're looking at a blended system in that farmers could continue to upload the documents they need in regards, say, the animal remedies, the concentrates purchases, the couple of bits around, say, the blue book, the flock register, that sort of stuff. But that they're hoping that they'll be able to have an on-farm element where they'll be able to come out, look at the aspects like, say, the animal handling facilities, the animal housing facilities, the chemical stores, the medicine stores, and that there won't need to be any, say, handling of documentation, in that COVID would still, say, remain front and centre in regards precautions there, but that they'll have that blended approach in that sort of month, 6 weeks' time.
Okay. Last one, Darren. The sheep kill was down in 21. I thought there was more ewes in the country. I thought there was more sheep. I thought you were making so much money that there was more and more ewes in the country. But the sheep kill is down significantly for 2021.
Yeah, if you look at it, all goes back, Jack, to the first half of the year in the Tahaga troop, which was down just shy of 100,000 head. And that was, I suppose, maybe a combination of a lot of lambs killed in the year before that, but also a lower carryover. And look, I suppose there's a lot of confidence in sheep. There's a lot of confidence, but there's no new real young person coming in lambing more yours. There is, I suppose, maybe here and there, there is stories of it.
Yeah.
But the rate of attrition at the other side and
fellas... Right, is more.
Gone, yes.
And right. More getting out more than there is getting in. We had a new entrant in the quickfire there talking about getting in 1920, like, you know, but he's a rare species, though.
He is a rare species, Jack. And what's happening is that you're seeing more older farmers maybe reducing your numbers and going to a dry hogget system. And that's where it's being pushed from.
Yeah.
Look, there was 100,000 less hoggets. I think this year we're probably going to look at a swing of maybe 30, 40, maybe 50,000 more, say, sheep being carried over. Right. A couple of things, I suppose, adding to that. There was a slightly more ewes last spring lambing. Now, there was a bit of mortality as well, but the lamb kill has been pretty much similar to, say, the previous year. So I do think you'll get a bit more of that. I do think this year, and it should happen, is that fellas with plainer quality ewe lambs shouldn't be keeping them onto the ewe hogget stage. Fellas have tried that now for 3 years running. Yes, there's a good trade for your top of the pops hoggets, but like, if you can get a ewe hogget, Jack, selling between 160 and 170 this spring, why would you keep it to sell it at 140 to 150 next back end? And there was plenty of them selling at that last year.
Yeah. And like, Darren, like, I mean, price was up considerably. Like, you know, I mean, it's up. What was it up nearly 20, 25 euros, that kind of is that fair to say? Like,
yeah, sure. Look, it fluctuated across the year. At times it was up 35 euros, at times it was up maybe 15, but as the year as a whole, it was up 138 per kilo. Now, that's not taking the last week's figures in. There might be a slight bit of fluctuation there, but you're looking at 130, 135, maybe about 30 euros. Price where it is at the moment, 110 a kilo up. Price is starting somewhere. There has been a slight maybe weakening in the trade maybe this week, but price is somewhere between 710 to 730. Regular seller, 720 to 730. That's where you're looking.
Darren, 100%. Thanks for that. Listen, we'll chat again next week and see what the story is. Siobhan, you heard it from Darren there. He's trying to get out of buying straw from me completely. Like, he's putting in slats, like, you know what I mean? You're too expensive. Like, you're just going to have to come down with that price, aren't you?
Straw scheme's in now for 6 years, Jack, so we're happy out. You can put in the slats away, Darren.
Siobhan, you had a couple of nice features there over the... Sorry, I'm so late coming to you, but shut up, Adam or Darren. Like, they had a week off, were kind of just, it was this pent up emotion that they wanted to get out over Christmas. You had two nice features there over Christmas in that focus. You had a real nice feature on sustainability, and there was two big features in it. You know, one, Bruce Thompson up your country, up in Leash, a dairy farmer, and then you had Anise Cork. I forget his name, but you had Anise Cork. Yeah. What was his name? Sorry.
Paul Moore.
Moore. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So, I mean, just for guys that haven't read those pieces, and just to kind of flesh out some of the kind of pieces, like, I mean, Bruce Thompson, dairy farmer, commercial dairy farmer. I call him large scale. I think he's over 300 cows, you know. Yeah. I mean, but he's trying this piece, and he's done an off-field study on it, and he has a project ongoing with a couple of farmers up around there. He's very much going down the line that, listen, he wants to improve, I suppose, soil and soil conditioning, we'll say, and he's using beetles to a whole new level. Talk to me just kind of at the outside, as if someone hadn't read that piece, in terms of what's happened there.
Yeah, look, I suppose the beetles are kind of the last bit of it. So a bit like, yeah, he wants to look after his soil and everything, but Bruce wants to reduce his dependence on animal remedies and wormers and things like that. So the first thing he's doing is he's trying to implement a traffic light system. He's trying to build up immunity in his young animals. So he's done this himself. He's into this. He has a lab on the farm and everything, and he has graded his his farm on the load of the parasites, the parasite loading that's on those fields. So I suppose when, you know, traditionally, if you've calves on your farm, they probably go out to the field beside the calving shed the first time they go out, or they go near the farmyard anyway, and probably in a pet field, which is used a lot and probably has a high parasite load on it, and they're being exposed straight away to all these parasites. So he's trying to send, it's, you know, we all learned this when we were in school or ag science, you know, the leader follower system, try to put the calves out on the cleaner fields. So basically that's what Bruce is doing. And then gradually as the summer comes and as grass, you know, gets less available, they're exposed to an orange paddock where there's more parasites on that part of the field. And he's doing other things as well. So he moves them, you know, he moves them every, I think, 3 days. He's moving washer trucks. So like, they're all very simple things. If you think of animals congregating around a water truck, that area is going to have a high parasite load. So if we can move the washer truck when the animals come into the field, I know it's not a very simple thing to do, but when you think about the science behind it, it's simple. And then the dung beetles come in after. So he's, the dung beetles, I suppose, break down the dung pads.
Yeah.
And they break the life cycle of the parasite. So they break, the numbers then aren't as high. So the dung beetles basically suck all the water out of the dung pad. And they bring the dung, the earthworms then, I suppose it's dry. The earthworms can bring the dung down into the soil. He's improving his soil, but he's also putting the amount of parasites that are on his land because the life cycle is broken. So yeah, Bruce is trying to produce dung beetles on his farm, and he's now in his discussion group, the Amore discussion group, and they're in an EIP, and they're trying to roll, I suppose, first of all, they're trying to roll that traffic light system out on some of those farms. I think it's 10 or 12 farms that they're trying to do it on at the minute. So, yeah, look, he's a really interesting guy.
And it is, you know, it's an interesting to read piece, Siobhan, like, but alongside that, he's running a commercial dairy farm, I'd say. You know, I mean, he's not doing anything too different to change the system. Like, if you were to compare him on kind of dairy farmer metrics, whatever they are or whatever you want to pick, like, I mean, he's still achieving all those targets in terms of heifer growth rates and all. Or is he, like, I mean, in terms
of... And yourself and Aidan know Bruce, he's a really good dairy farmer, but I suppose this is just something he's interested in, and he's seen an area where he can reduce his costs. Like, the first reason he went into this was because he himself and his father realised that, you know, their wormer costs and things for fluke and all that were really expensive and adding up. And he's reduced his cost by 78% on his wormers. So I suppose he's being a good businessman here. He saw an area where he could improve, and that's what he's trying to do now. And I suppose it helps that he's interested in it as well.
Yeah. No, and speaking of business, and that was what was striking me when I talked when I read the piece, the Middleton article, we'll say, in East Cork. Like, I mean, he's a tillage farmer, so he's a big interest in birds and biodiversity on his farm. But he's still a tillage farmer at heart, isn't he? In terms of the commercial business, is that what's making him the money? Like, we'll say
he's a conventional farmer. He has beef on the farm as well, so he's a fairly typical mixed beef tillage farm, like. And he's farming, you know, he's farming the same way any other tillage farmer is farming. He's applying his fertilizer, he's spraying his crops with chemicals, and he's farming conventionally in the area of the field where you can grow the crop. And then he looks after things like his hedgerows, his trees. He has Dutch elm disease on the farm, and he leaves some of those trees up for wood-borne insects, and they help to provide feed for other animals and birds on the farm. He leaves his hedges grow. He has cover crops. He has wild bird cover. And they're things like that are part of the loss scheme. But his income is coming from the tillage farm, and he's very clear about that. And he's very clear that you can have an intensive farm and a conventional farm making money, but also farm alongside nature and do very simple things to improve biodiversity on the farm.
Yeah, and they're not costly things either, Siobhan. You know, I mean, in terms of, I mean, I was struck by his interest in the various species of birds, you know, and like, I mean, a lot of farmers have a kind of a real interest in birds because, like, I mean, they're farming with them every day, you know, the kind of way, like, but he had a real strong interest in the different types of birds. And I mean, where did that come from, Siobhan, in terms of his original, did you get an insight into that in terms of why, how kind of he first became interested in that whole, I call it biodiversity, not birds, like, you know what I
mean? Yeah, he just said, like, since he was young, like since he was 5 or 6, he used to be out watching these birds and just trying to learn, you know, trying to learn about them, I suppose. And then he joined Birdwatch Ireland. Wow. And, you know, he's in Birdwatch Ireland years. And, you know, as he said himself, it was kind of seen as a bit of an odd thing for a farmer to be in Birdwatch Ireland at the time he joined. But isn't it a great thing that he's in it, you know, that there's someone there, and we need to see more of this happening, you know, that there's an intensive farmer, like he's a member of that. I think he was on the board, like, you know, that there's an intensive farmer shouting the case for what he's doing on the farm. You know, a lot of the people, you know, these environmentalists and everything, you know, assume that you can't farm conventionally and that we need to rewild the whole of Ireland. Whereas we don't, like, there was one thing that really struck me about him. You know, we see all these rules coming in, like we were talking about nitrates earlier on, and we talked about the ones for that dairy farmer, but a rule coming in tillage is that all overwinter stubble will have to be tilled and regenerated. But that's going to have a massive impact on some bird species, like skylarks need overwinter stubble, and it's because they like to be able to look down on the stubble and find, they want to find the bit of grain that they're left over, and they want to find insects, and it's easy for them to see. So if every, you know, if that nitrate now is probably going to go through, we're going to have no overwinter stubble in Ireland, and those birds are going to have nowhere to go.
And can they not feed on grassland, Siobhan? Like, we'll say, you know, I call it relatively bare grassland over the winter. Can they not?
No, there's some of them, like, are dependent on overwinter stubble, and there's some that will do both. So, you know, there's a yellowhammer can go into a cover crop, but there's some that want that overwinter stubble. And like we've seen the area of tillage decline, and now, and then we kind of saw a turn to winter crop.
I know.
And now there'll be no overwinter stubble. So those birds are rolling out of state.
Now, to fight the other case, like, I mean, the department are saying, listen, this is important because of nutrients and trying to manage nutrients from fallow crops, we'll say, over the winter. You know, so there's, like, but what you're saying is, while they might be winning there in terms of soaking up those nutrients, they're losing that kind of an element of biodiversity because the skylark has no place to feed.
Yeah, look, and I'm a big fan of cover crops, and I'm a big fan of green cover, but there was no sign. Was there any research? I don't think there was in the Nitrates Directive investigation into whether it was going to affect those birds or not. Or does anyone care it's going to affect those birds? So, look, there is loads of benefits, but we can leave areas, you know, and we can leave it in areas where there's, you know, less of a risk to water. We can leave areas of overwinter stubble.
Super stuff. Last question, Siobhan, because I know we're running up to time. In terms of, you have a hedgerows piece in this week. I mean, just again, give us a flavour for kind of what's in it and what's important at this time of the year, I suppose, for some farmers that are thinking of doing something to hedgerows or planting or kind of management, I suppose.
Yeah, first of all, I suppose, you know, reminding people about their obligations. So if you're in derogation, you have to be on a tree rotation, or else you have to be leaving a white thorn tree along those hedges. And then, you know, things, so we can only cut hedges until the end of February. If you are cutting, you know, try and leave them to 1.5 metre. And if you can, easier said than done to get the contractors to do, but try leave the slant on the hedge. You can plant until St. Patrick's Day. And then, look, we're not advocating taking out hedges, but in some instances, hedges need to be taken out. And maybe it's because the hedge is gone past rejuvenation. If you are taking out a hedge, it has to be planted back before you take it out. And if you're taking out more than 500 metres over, I think, a 5-year period, you know, so if you take out 100 metres every year over 5 years, you need permission to take that out from the Department of Agriculture, and that hedge has to be replaced before it's taken out. And the department can look back as far as 2009 on your map. So, you know, if you get an inspection this year and a hedge was taken out in 2010, that hedge had to have been replaced somewhere. So yeah, and look, an ideal time for planting hedges. I suppose looking ahead then in 2023, farmers will be getting paid for planting hedges. And if you think you're going to take one of those measures throughout the year, just try and think, where would a hedge be best suited on my farm? Try and see, is there an area where there's sediment going into a drain, or is there an area where stock needs shelter? Be thinking of these things, and you know, when it comes to next year, don't just land a hedge in any other spot.
Like. Yeah, that's the eco scheme measure you're talking about in terms of the cap job. Like,
yeah,
that's one of the options is to plant. Nice one. Thanks, Siobhan. Am I right, Siobhan? If there's an R in the month, you can plant a hedge. Is that was back at yonks ago when I, you know, way before my time. If there was an R in the month, you goes okay to plant a hedge.
I wouldn't be planting a hedge in April.
Would you not like? Yeah,
there is a phrase there. I think you have the wrong letter.
Maybe the R is the wrong letter. We'll check it out for next week, Siobhan.
Anyway, it's first frost to Patrick.
Right, okay. Patrick's Day, you were saying. So you're ruling out April. Thanks for that, Siobhan. Chat soon. Folks, earlier I flagged that Adam had chatted to John O'Loughlin from Grassland Agro about fertiliser, gas, slurry, and everything that's happening in that space. Let's have a listen.
John, I guess I've never spoken to farmers more about fertiliser in the month of December ever before in my career. It's really a topic of conversation at the moment. I suppose we've seen some news in the last couple of days or weeks that gas prices, and look, we've heard about gas prices and that's the driver of fertilizer prices, but the gas prices has come back maybe a bit in the last week of December. And there are some people now hoping that will impact, I suppose, fertilizer prices, and fertilizer prices will come down. What's the thinking, I suppose, or what's the intelligence there within the industry? Or just explain to us, I guess, why gas prices drive fertilizer prices, or what's the whole, we'll say, procedure there?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, Adam. It's a really, really important topic. Like, and I suppose the big thing is that there's data and context is really important. So like to come out with a statement and say that Cavan are still in the All-Ireland series, like, you know, it's technically true, but 'tis the 5th or the 8th of January now, like, you know. But I suppose with the gas prices, really, it's a bit of a false dawn. So it's, I suppose, reported in the media that gas prices have fallen a lot. But what you have to flip around to is 2 weeks before that, gas prices absolutely surged. The city prices, they were up 70% off a very high base and a week or two before that. And what we've seen is that they've come down slightly. So technically, yes, gas prices have fallen, but they're only back to the same price, Adam, where they were on the 1st of December. And even since maybe those articles came out, there's actually been a significant strengthening in gas as well. And there's a huge amount of market factors at play. You know, Russia, Ukraine, all these things that have been heavily spoken about and unfortunately are outside of our control. But in relation to fertilizer, it's still a very serious topic, and it's still a big headache for everyone. And the strong prices are 100% set to remain, and there'll be no softening of prices for a long time. Gas price is critical to all that, and it's still very, very high, Adam.
So what you're saying is, John, that it's still relative to 2020 or 2019, gas price is still a lot higher than what it was in those years, and that's what makes fertilizer so expensive at the moment.
100%, and even like there's other factors contributing now. I suppose any organization there are seeing the effects of COVID. Like it's nearly impossible to organize a game of five-a-side, you know, with different people being out. So there's all the implications of COVID across China, across Russia, across all the main manufacturers. There's also a situation then as well, Adam, where I suppose the national inventory is much lower, and the international inventory is much lower than it was previously in other years. So there's estimates that maybe 30% of the nitrogen that we'd normally have available to buy and purchase and then to bring forward to the merchants and co-ops isn't there. So I suppose it's back to what we were saying previously, that it is that important to focus on trying to get your fertilizer secured, because regardless, even at the prices of fertilizer, which are very high, and no one wants to see them that high, it's an awful lot more risk for us, number one, Adam. It's an awful lot more risk for a merchant, and most importantly, for a farmer. But even at the prices they're at, it's still a very good investment, provided you have your lime and your P and K right, to get the value from the nitrogen, grow the forage and utilize it. It's still the cheapest feed by far. I see a lot of articles in the journal from yourself or Aidan, saying highlighting the value of grass and forage, and even with fertilizer prices, it's still going to be the cheapest. And grass is very much still king. And in order to grow that, we will need to use the fertilizer.
I suppose, speaking to farmers on the ground, John, like I would have spoken to farmers before Christmas and over Christmas, and the general thinking, and I'm being honest in this, the general thinking in the West is that no way will I spend that amount of money on fertilizer. I'll hold off. Fertilizer prices will come back in the spring or the summer, or I'll just keep less cattle or I'll cut less silage. But that's a real risky, I suppose, strategy in terms of those farms, because what I think maybe could happen is there'll be the biggest amount of fertilizer goes out on a dry stock farm for a silage cut. That silage fertilizer will be cut back. You'll have a small cut of silage, and possibly it'll be spring 2023 when it'll come back to bite us this in terms of bales running out or a silage pit wall coming up at you a lot quicker than was before that.
Definitely, Adam. And I suppose, like, you know, there's a whole host of different farmers in different situations. And if you take the west of Ireland, like maybe the guys that were going in for the 2 ton and saying, what did I get last year and we'll get it again this year? You know, those guys, maybe they should just take one or two soil samples and spread lime. You know, and I would be 100% sure that they'd be able to carry similar amounts of stock. There's also legislative stuff in relation to keeping less stock and reference years as well, and how that could impact their businesses going forward that they have to take into account too. But getting the lime right is just a quick win, and investing a small bit of money in lime could unlock the same amount of nitrogen as they had been spreading. In relation to the west of Ireland, though, it's a great point, because we know we have longer winters. You know, and if you take into account a lot of bale silage, typical good crop of first cut silage now, and this is the west of Ireland definition, is 12 bales an acre. Like, you know, if you take 12 bales at 250 kilos of dry matter per bale, that's equivalent to 7 or 8 ton dry matter per hectare. You know, so that's actually really good performance when we say that the national average dry stock farmer is only growing that, which is maybe getting missed in pasture base or whatever. But there's those big crops being grown, and we know that we always need them. You know, silage is a very important commodity in the system of, you know, a suckler or dry stock farm. And we often say the quality could be better and it could cut a little bit earlier or whatever, but it's always important to have it available, you know, however good, bad or indifferent it is.
What is your advice, John, to farmers? I guess on Tullamore Farm, we talked to our own fertilizer, local fertilizers, we'll say merchant in Tullamore, and he advised us to look at buying 6 or 8 ton of urea, and we've done that just to have it basically for the first round, just to get us through maybe to, you know, March or April time. But what are you saying to farmers at the moment? Like, that urea is costing us €900 a ton. It's a massive cost to any sister, and even to have that cash on a dry stock farm, in you know, because a lot of merchants now are looking for that money, obviously maybe paid when the product comes, and there's not a lot of credit with it. It's going to put a huge, we'll say, you know, noose around a lot of dry stock farmers in terms of buying that fertilizer this spring.
Yeah, definitely. It's a big challenge, like, and I suppose everyone is in the same boat. We're in the same boat offering the fertilizer, and that's why we all want to see the gas price go down, things go back to normal. There's an awful lot less risk. But I suppose on a dry stock situation, you're obviously turning out very early, and you're at the Tony Kelly levels of farm management there, like. But it really depends on when you purchase based on your turnout date. So in the west of Ireland, we're not going to be turning out until St. Patrick's Day. You know, there's no real point in spreading fertilizer in February. But I would still say it would be important to secure something, because that's when the crunch is going to come. And even thinking about securing that silage fertilizer going forward, Adam, which is the be all and end all for a lot of lads, is going to be very important, because that's when the crunch will come. And as we've been seeing, as we've been offering consignments to merchants and co-ops, is that it's been snapped up and it's getting moved quickly, which is great, so that we can have the confidence to go and get more. But we're finding a big challenge to actually find and source fertilizer because of all the topics we discussed, at any price, you know, and that's a big challenge in order to potentially mitigate a fodder crisis when that will come. It could be 2023, as you said. But I suppose the key things, the simple things that any dry stock farmer could do, is to secure something, right? You have that in the yard, it's going to be very valuable, and use it then as effectively as possible. And I would say that this year more than ever, Adam, there is absolutely no farm in the country that can't afford to have their lime right. And it's been something, I'd say, we've chatted a good few times on Tech Talks. It's something that you often cover in your articles. But now is the time. This is championship. We have to make sure that we get these things right. And really, you know, €25 a ton for a ton of lime, like in comparison, you know, you buy a load of lime for a ton of urea now.
Yes.
And that's such a simple, small thing. And that's spread as well, like. But it's getting that organized, getting the ground conditions and just doing it. Just actually going out and doing it is the most important.
Is there anything that farmers need to be aware of, I suppose, coming into springtime as regards spreading lime? Is it okay, for example, you know, spreading lime on ground that might be cut for silage, maybe in May time, or spreading lime on ground that's going to be grazed by suckler cows, or do you just bite the bullet and try and get it out now to try and improve your pH? So that you're saying that any fertilizer then you spread, well, hopefully that pH will be lifted, so it'll be more efficient, basically, to spread that fertilizer.
There's a bit of a, you know, there's the usual rules there. You go with the lime last if you're going with urea, but a lot of dry stock farmers mightn't be going that early. I know on the Tullamore farm, you probably have naturally high pHs in around there anyway, yeah. So it's not as much of an issue for yourselves. But I suppose the big thing, and I've been, before the COVID got as bad as it was, we've been going around doing a lot of field events. And the one thing that really stuck with everyone is that there's dry stock farmers, there's dairy farmers, there's tillage farmers that have been paying these crazy prices for fertilizer for the last 10 or 15 years. And the reason for that is very simple, is that their pH has been so bad. And if you're only getting 30% efficiency out of urea that costs 300, it's 900 it's actually costing you.
Yeah.
But there's no farmer in the country that can afford to pay 2,700 for that urea if they're only getting 30% efficiency out. And that's something that's very small, but it's something that has to sink in going forward, and we have to get better at, because I suppose, Adam, one of the big things with all this sustainability, the environment and water quality, it's not a dairy problem, it's not a tillage farmer problem, it's not a suckler farmer or dry stock sheep. It's all of agriculture. No, it's everyone. And sometimes we get kind of maybe, you know, it is their fault, like, or whatever, but it's everyone, and we all have to maybe do a little bit to try and bring the whole thing along.
So lime is one option, I guess. Slurry, and it's a cheap option. And slurry is another cheap option on farm. We have it on every farm. And I know sometimes on dry stock farms, we look upon that slurry as being a burden and a hassle in terms of getting rid of it. And sometimes it's left at the last minute to get it back out again, we'll say in the autumn time. But what are we saying? Like, we're just around the corner now from, well, we'll say it's the 1st of February up in the west, but the 13th and the 16th of February, or sorry, January, down through the country. What's the best way, or what have you some advice there for farmers in terms of utilising slurry, you know, this spring to maximise the fertilizer effect of that slurry?
Definitely. I suppose you're ideally trying to get your slurry out to your silage ground in a normal year, because that's where all the nutrients have come from. This year we're trying to stretch it so that we can get it out on the grazing ground to displace that early nitrogen as well. And there's just one problem with all this is, and we've talked, everyone's talking about slurry and what it can and can't do, but there's only a fixed amount. So we have to be really strategic with it. And ideally what we're trying to do is to get it out early in springtime, so that's when we're going to get the maximum efficiency with less, so that we can maximize the nitrogen content and the nitrogen value as well, Adam. But ideally what we need to do is try and get it out onto a low cover on the grazing ground, and then try and get as much of it back to the silage ground early as possible. A lot of dry stock farmers maybe make their first cut and then go out with a splash plate after the first cut, and it's left lying there. Do you know, the field goes from pure white to pure brown, and you're getting very low utilization out of the nitrogen. So I would be saying, even to dry stock lads, considering getting a contractor even to do a bit with the dribble bar. There's a big contractor in West Clare, Pat Corbett, that actually got a dribble bar, does a lot of work for the dry stock side of the house. And a lot of these customers are very happy, and they've improved a lot now, where even bale silage will go through macerators and stuff like that. And you will be able to stretch it that little bit more. You can go a little bit lower rate and get the bounce out of the nitrogen by using the less. And it'll more than pay for itself this year with the price of nitrogen too.
I suppose application rate, what tends to happen up this end of the country, you'll get a good week's weather, maybe in, I suppose, first week of February, second week of February, and there'll be a big panic to you. Tanks emptied and contractor will pull into the yard, they'll have one reel of pipes with them, and that slurry will go to maybe fields around the shed because they're in a panic to get away again. But in terms of application rate, could we lower that application rate, or what's the ideal application rate to try and get the most out of that slurry, that we're not sort of piling it all onto maybe a silage field close to the shed, that we're maybe lowering that rate to try and maximise it out?
Yeah, definitely, Adam. I say slurry is kind of like small ones on a night out. You only want to be going less than two. You know, so or a maximum of two, like, you know, and go a little and often, like, so that you don't want to get into a situation where you're horsing it all out over a small area. And you can see nearly like heat maps of soil fertility around farms where the yard is always very high in P and K. What we need to do is reduce the quantity that's being applied and move it around the farm. And even with the pipes, it's a huge point. You'd often see that a massive tank goes out over 30 or 40 acres and it could be applied at 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 gallons an acre. But I suppose it's worth investing that extra hour to get them to roll out the pipes, go the extra distance, cover more ground. And that, in fact, has a big impact on soil biology as well. You'd often see loads of dead earthworms and stuff like that after the place gets poisoned with slurry. So, like, slurry is such a valuable resource. The value has gone up in line with fertilizer prices as well. So what used to be 25 euro per 1,000 gallons applied with less is now worth 50, 60 euros per 1,000 gallons. And that's something that we can't lose sight of.
And are we saying to target a spring application? If we can at all, you're saying definitely it's a spring application rather than a summer application on field.
Yeah, 100%. Even no matter what way you apply it, even if you apply with a dribble bar in summertime, you're not getting the same utilization out of them. You're getting more nitrogen out of that. And I suppose the other thing is that, and I don't want to confuse it, but we often talk about the available nitrogen in slurry. There's also maybe the same amount, again, in an organic farm that will become available during the year. So the earlier that you get that out, the more benefit you're going to get out of it. And 100%, we have to be thinking about getting out earlier with slurry across all farm systems. Like, you know, I know maybe some dry stock farmers might be a little bit slower, but this year, you know, take that bag of cutsward off what you normally use with your 4 or 5 bags of cutsward. You know, that's a huge saving. And you're going to grow better quality silage as well because you'd have more P's and K's out.
Right, very interesting. Thanks to John O'Loughlin from Grassland Agro for joining us. Right, folks, that's it for another week. Thanks for watching and thanks indeed for listening. Thanks to all our own specialists, Siobhan, Adam and Darren. If you want more Farmers Journal podcasts or webinars, go to ifj.ie/podcasts or ifj.ie/webinars. We'll be back again next week. So until then, stay safe and stay farming.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.